Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I am Raj Patel. I'm an academic, an activist. I'm the author of The Value of Nothing, and I am in my 20s or 30s. So tonight, I'm very excited to be here with Anna LaPay and Francis Moore LaPay. And let's start with Francis, because before Michael Pollan, before Jamie's Food Revolution and Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation, decades before, though not too long ago, Francis wrote Diet for a Small Planet. It shaped the thinking and activism of a generation. It sold over 3 million copies, and it is in every way a modern classic. Now, Frankie is the co-founder of three national organizations that explore the roots of hunger, poverty, and environmental crises, including here in the Bay Area, Food First, where I'm a fellow. And she is the author of 18 books, including Hope's Edge, which she wrote with her daughter, Anna LaPay. Anna herself is a force for change in her own right, recognized by Time as part of Time's Eco's Who's Who. And she studied at Columbia and Brown and is on the board of the Rainforest Action Network and is the author, most recently, of Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It, published by Bloomsbury right now. Now, we'll get into a discussion about climate change and the most recent research that Anna's done. But, Frankie, I want to turn to you first and ask you, you've seen the arc of the food debate, and I'm curious to see, curious to hear from you, what you think has, you know, what are the myths that have remained the same? What do you find yourself banging your head against year after year? And then I'm going to ask you what you think has changed most recently. But what is it that you find most difficult to get across? What is it that's a persistent myth?
Square one, where I started back in UC Berkeley Ag Library at age 26 when I had my aha moment, and I'm still trying to communicate my aha moment. That moment was when I realized that actually there's more than enough food in the world to feed us all. The newspaper headlines, the experts were telling us, no, we're running out of food, there's not enough, that's the reason for hunger. And I put kind of literally two and two together, and I realized, no, they're wrong. And actually, what the truth is that we, this brainy species, are actually creating scarcity out of plenty. That we have, in a way, turned our food system into a waste system, a disposal, the destruction system, and now with the heating of the planet in a whole new way. So I guess the beating my head against the wall is, wait a minute, folks, we're asking the wrong question. It's not, how do we produce more? How do we produce more? We're running out of food. Oh, yes, we need a new GMO to do that. It is, what is it in our system that has us creating what we fear, the waste and destruction we fear? That's the core question that I've been pursuing.
But then, what is new? I mean, if 30 years of trying to address that, I mean, have things changed? Have you noticed new features of the way in which we can address hunger?
Absolutely. I just want to say, though, about this beating my head against the wall. Not too long ago, Anna said to me, Mom, don't feel too bad that you keep having to say the same thing over and over and over and over. Remember, Coke does the same thing, you know? They just keep pushing the same ad. So,
and spending a lot of money.
And spending a lot of money, so don't feel so bad. The way I think of it is that we're moving very, very fast, faster and faster, in two different directions. And at the same time that the destruction and the waste and destruction is intensifying as we've fallen for these wacky ideas that somehow a market works by itself and it ends up creating more and more concentration and destruction. So that's happening. And at the very same time, what gets me out of bed in the morning is the realization in the places on Earth that you know, when Anna and I travel the globe together, the places on Earth where we least expect these incredible breakthroughs and possibility, they are emerging, as you know, Raj. Mm-hmm. And whether I'm talking Africa, India, Brazil, Central America, we have so much to learn. And so part of my passion right now is just to let Americans know what is working so we will believe in possibility.
And one of the other things that you were mentioning earlier on before we got on stage was the sort of generational shift. The idea that certainly when you wrote Diet for a Small Planet, it felt like it was a generation against the world. What I'm excited about and excited where this conversation might lead is the idea that actually now we have several generations against the tilting against.
That's a huge change.
Talk to me about how it is that you experience that working with Anna.
And my son, too. Both of my children now. So I feel it in my own family. And, of course, I'm working now on my two granddaughters. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. I already enlisted one at a news conference against McDonald's. I feel it. I think probably everyone here has had that experience where it's not like the 60s generation where we were battling against the elders, that the young, I feel right now in the books that I've been writing recently that my most emphatic response is from young people, particularly young men, interestingly enough. And so my new best friends are all under 30. So what can I say? It's really intergenerational. And that in itself, I think, is huge, that we don't have to discount each other, but can really value what we each generation brings to the problem solving. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and I've certainly experienced it in working with my mother, that that there is such power in working with, I don't know, do you mind if I call you an elder? but there's power in working across generations. And, of course, what we are talking about trying to change, it takes longer than a generation to change, to shift. It takes longer than two generations. And I remember talking with another person who is about my age, and he works with his father. And I remember somebody asking him, do you find it strange to be working with your father so closely? And, have you ever kind of felt like you really needed to rebel against him? And I remember this guy who we were talking to about this dynamic. He said, there's enough in the world to rebel against. I don't need to rebel against the politics of my father. And I feel the same way about this relationship that my mother and I have that goes so deep, both as mother and daughter, but also as partners in this work. There is plenty to rebel against. I certainly never felt the need to rebel against the core messages of her life's work.
Let's get to what it is that is worth rebelling against. Let's get to this idea of climate change. The notion is that climate change is really the burden of a new generation, and it's in fact a generational gift. A burden of what the old have bequeathed the young. What do you see as where do you see the burdens being the greatest? Let's start there.
I mean, where the burdens of where the climate crisis is really going to hit home the hardest? Well, I mean, we're already seeing it. The burdens are really being felt worst and most profoundly in those communities that have the least economic resources currently to deal with those burdens. And actually, where we're seeing the impact of the climate crisis the most are on farming communities, especially in the developing world. And, of course, small island nations are feeling it already. And so that was actually one of the things that I found so powerful about talking about this food and climate connection and talking about the role that sustainable food systems can play in helping to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, helping us adapt to climate change, helping us mitigate climate change. What instantly happens when you start having that conversation is all of a sudden you start seeing that those small-scale farmers who are still struggling on the land around the planet, you start seeing that those people have this vital role in helping us address the crisis. And you start seeing and revaluing the role of farmers as those who are potentially tending the soils, our carbon-rich, potentially carbon-rich soils, as well as feeding the planet. And so for me, that was one of the shifts that happened when I started looking at this food and climate connection, really seeing farmers as climate heroes and seeing the small-scale farmers who are currently being most affected by climate change, also those who, in this kind of reframing of the issue, can be seen as kind of at the forefront of helping us heal the climate.
And so another way of saying that, is this beautiful unity of the root solution to hunger and poverty is very much the root solution to a big part of climate change. So I love that idea that as we're working on one, we're working on all of this together.
And I also think it's about then kind of breaking down these artificial barriers between us as eaters who may not be food producers and food producers who, of course, are also eaters, but food producers, and really seeing that there's a relationship that we can have with each other in the marketplace that isn't currently what we have as where I think a lot of times we see ourselves as kind of in competition with food producers trying to get the cheapest price from those producers, for instance. And a really beautiful model of this that I saw in research was going to South Korea and talking with leaders in the food co-ops, in the food co-op movement in South Korea. And they talked about part of the movement of these food co-ops was this this getting people who lived in cities like Seoul, in these big urban areas, getting these people to see food as something political, but also getting these people to see their relationship with the farmers in a different way. And these co-ops, just to give you a sense of the scale we're talking about, I belong to a 13,000-person co-op in Brooklyn, which I kind of thought was kind of big. In South Korea, the co-ops I met with, one was 50,000 members big. The other one was 150,000 members. So these are big, big social institutions. And engaged in this really radical transformation of thinking about eaters in the marketplace. And the example that they offered me of this transformation is they tell me that this one co-op told me that every year there's sort of a running joke in the co-op, because every year the customer representatives and the farmer representatives get together to collectively decide on the price that the co-op member should pay for the basic basket of goods that the co-op farmers are going to sell. And the joke is that every year at these co-op meetings, it ends in a big friendly fight, because you have the consumer reps saying, we want to pay you more. We want to pay you more, farmers, because you're providing us this vital thing that our families need, healthy food. And you deserve more than that market price for rice, for instance. And every year the farmers fight right back and say, no, we want you to pay less because we know you're struggling and we don't want you to pay more. And really this doesn't cost us as much as the market price is currently saying it costs us. And so they end up having this friendly fight, but the message of that friendly fight is that there's been a transformation on both sides of that story, of the food producers and these eaters really seeing that they are responsible for each other. They are essentially share the same values and share the same needs, and it's a transformation that these co-ops have really been a part of creating.
But then walk us through how that's linked to climate change. I mean, that seems like a sort of blissful moment of people getting along when economics says they oughtn't to. But where does climate change fit into this friendly fight?
Well, where climate change fits into this friendly fight is that most of us aren't having this friendly fight with our food producers. Most of us, and increasingly all around the world, most of us are consuming food in a marketplace that looks very different from that, in a marketplace where we have absolutely no relationship to those food producers, where the producers at the end of the chain are often getting just a tiny fraction of what we spend for our food, and where the decisions that are made about how our food is produced, what is grown, what happens to the food that's grown, is totally disconnected from us. So that now you have a food system here in this country that's highly industrialized, in which most of what's grown is being grown with heavily chemical-intensive farming, highly dependent on fossil fuels, highly dependent on synthetic fertilizer, which takes an enormous amount of natural gas to produce, and thus emissions related to that, where you have, as my mother described in Diet for a Small Planet, the same trends of factory farm meat, where we're taking the abundant crops that we grow in this country and putting it into our feedlot farming system that give back to us just a tiny fraction of what we put in. And so this is the food economy in which most of us operate. It isn't that one that I saw a little glimpse of there in South Korea, where where there was a real democracy embedded in the decisions that were made about how food was being grown and who got access to it and how much it costs.
And are those farmers farming ecologically as well?
Yeah, and actually what was really exciting about my time in South Korea is that I met with farmer groups that were part of that co-op, and then I also met with farmer groups that were part of an international movement of food producers called La Via Campesina. And the conversation that was at the foremost of those meetings that I had and the meetings the food producers were having with each other was this awakening to the impact of industrial agriculture on the climate. They're very aware of what I think is still invisible to most of us, which is our industrial food system is responsible by some counts for as much as one-third of all global greenhouse gas emissions. So they're very aware of the impact of industrial agriculture, and these small farmer groups were saying, look, not only can we produce enough food to feed the world, but our farming practices reduce carbon dioxide emissions on the farm, reduce methane and nitrous oxide emissions on the farm, and therefore can help us mitigate climate change. Their slogan, La Via Campesina's slogan at the time was, small-scale farmers can feed the world and cool the planet.
I just wanted to underscore Anna's point with the number that just is astonishing to me. When we think about what is involved in both ending poverty and hunger and cooling the planet, clearly for me, a democratic economics is part of it. And for a lot of us, it's hard to get our head around what is democratic economics, a really empowered farming sector. And so we hear the word co-op, as Anna was mentioning, in South Korea. Co-op is a democratic form. And I learned recently that there are as many people in the world who are members of cooperatives as who own shares in publicly traded companies, that this is not a marginal sector. And in our own country, think about, I'm sure many of you know, Organic Valley started out with just a handful of farmers in 1988, and now is a $500 million business growing organic dairy, which is part of the solution.
And fruits and vegetables.
And fruits. So anyway, I just wanted to, because sometimes I think people hear co-op and they think, oh, that's nice, that's sweet, but that's kind of irrelevant. But it actually is a major force, a growing force, that can democratize our understanding of how an economy works.
But some corporations are not so benign, and I'm intrigued. One of the ways in which we're encouraged to respond to climate change is to shop smarter and to buy things that have the appropriate labels on them. In Europe, there's a new sort of regime. If you go to the Tesco supermarket, you'll find the carbon footprint of your packet of crisps, or potato chips, as they are vulgarly known here. Can we expect corporations to lead us out of the woods here? I mean, you've just mentioned a corporation that you're looking at quite favorably. Do you think corporations are able to get us out of the trouble of climate change?
Well, I mentioned Organic Valley, you mean? Mm-hmm. That is a democratic cooperative. I mean, it is not organized as a one share, one vote, but one farmer member, one vote. So it is a very different kind of operation where the profit returns to rural communities, and it is committed to organic.
Right, and it's very mission.
It's mission-driven.
Support small-scale farmers.
So I think it's not appropriate to lump it in with a profit-only-driven corporation. And I guess, my big picture look at for how I put my head around it is that as long as we fall for this idea that an economy driven by one rule, that is highest return to existing wealth, those who own the shares in the corporations and run them, that we will continue the concentration of power, which in and of itself is problematic. In if you look at human beings, we don't do well with concentrated power, and it means that we can be very non-transparent. It means that we don't have to incorporate the impact of the natural world and what we're doing, as long as we can keep making those returns. So I think that's the key issue. And to use now, sort of the wake up, is to see where corporate agribusiness in particular has taken us, mm-hmm. with the most precious need of all, that is to eat well, to thrive, to thrive as a biological entity, that we've turned food into a health hazard, we've turned farming into a hazard to climate change as well as to farm workers and to water and soil. That should be the wake-up call of all wake-up calls, that there's fundamentally amiss with our understanding of economics.
But if you say we don't do well with concentrated power, say McDonald's would respond by saying, well, where else are you going to get a meal, get a burger for a dollar? Surely McDonald's and Walmart and a range of companies that provide cheap food for the consumption of people who are on low incomes are doing people a favor. How would you respond to that in terms of a corporation saying, no, actually, we've got your best interests at heart here?
Well, my first reaction is to think of the children, that now 1 in 3 American children will be diabetic. 1 in 3. And it's very linked to the kinds of ingredients that are in these cheap meals. And then the games they play with kids to draw them into that is really frightening. I asked my 3-year-old granddaughter, I said, Josie, how do you think corporations draw, you know, trick kids to eat things that really are going to make them sick over their lifetime. She said, toys. I said, have you ever been to a McDonald's? She said, no. And I said, well, how do you know? And she pointed her finger at her head like that. So it doesn't take a PhD in economics to figure this out.
But those tricks are also being played in the climate change debate. There are a lot of wonderful things about your book, but I really enjoyed the discussion of greenwashing that you've got there. Right. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. And just to go back to your question about kind of the Walmart, McDonald's, and the cheap food, you know, I think we also need to talk about the other side of the food equation and being able to feed ourselves is having a living wage and being able to have enough money to buy food. Now, if companies like Walmart and McDonald's paid better wages, people would be able to afford food that didn't cost the bargain basement prices of McDonald's and Walmart. So I think that Walmart really has done a very good job at messaging itself as saying, you know, we're providing this really cheap products for people, and has really been able to hide behind a veil when what we should really be having a conversation about is, as one of the largest private employers in the country, how have the choices that Walmart has made to depress wages so heavily, you know, how has that affected people's ability to feed themselves? But to go back to your question about how companies have really kind of taken the greenwashing message and looking at it through the climate lens, you know, I think you just mentioned that McDonald's, for instance, and what McDonald's has been saying, and my niece Josie's comments about the toys and how that gets kids hooked on the food. And it's been really interesting to see how companies like McDonald's have been kind of advertising the new them and kind of spinning the new story of how they are going green. I think it says a lot, actually, in a positive way. It says a lot about how these companies are sensing that a lot of us care about these issues and that they feel the need to speak to them. But I think we need to kind of dig a little bit beneath the surface to see, are they really changing and not just changing the outside packaging. So just to give you one example that I think is particularly striking, I remember going to an industry green marketing conference, and they had a representative from McDonald's, the chief marketing officer of McDonald's, to speak about how McDonald's is actually going green. That you might think McDonald's is a fast food company, but she was there to tell everybody that it's actually a company about building community and a company about sustainability. And she even had to illustrate this. She had, during her presentation, she had up on the PowerPoint the yellow arches that we're all familiar with of the McDonald's, except it was green to indicate, yes, they're going green. And her big announcement she was very proud of was that the European McDonald's were just announcing in partnership with Conservation International, they were just announcing a brand new eco-themed Happy Meal called the Endangered Species Happy Meal. And with this Happy Meal, kids like my niece Josie could choose from a little fluffy Siberian tiger, a cute little polar bear, or six other endangered species. And then they could go online, which is a big new trend for these companies to kind of continue to hook kids by providing them games and activities online, where you could go online and learn the simple things you could do to help the planet. Now, of course, on that list of the simple things you could do, missing from that list was don't buy a Happy Meal and don't eat the food inside of it. But just to give you a bit of a taste of how different this is, what a turn this is for McDonald's, flashback just a year and a half ago, and the Happy Meal looked a little bit different. A year and a half ago, McDonald's partnered with General Motors for a slightly different themed Happy Meal. That would be the Hummer-themed Happy Meal, where the Happy Meal came along with little miniature Hummer cars. They also, I thought this was kind of bizarre, at the same time they had that, of course, only boys would want cars, right? So for the girls, you could get the Polly Pocket doll, but for the boys, you could get the Hummers. So they partnered with General Motors, did the Hummer-themed Happy Meal, gave away 42 million of these Happy Meals. That's enough for every single person in Canada to get one, plus some, right? So the point is that what we need to be demanding and what we need to be looking for is real change. And I don't think just changing the packaging and changing the toys inside a Happy Meal is equivalent of real change.
So what is real change? I mean, again, as I say, I mean, is it for us to be you know, all right, we won't go to McDonald's, we'll go to In-N-Out. I mean, what's the answer? I mean, can we carry on much as we are at the moment, but just sort of buy the right things? Or is there a way of making it, laying it out for us in a way that makes it easy?
Well, the way I like to think of it is you know, clearly, I think on a daily basis, we, unlike many other things that we do in our lives, we do eat every day. And we often are, if we're not growing all of our own food, we're making choices then about the food we buy, if not every day, very frequently. And so clearly there are opportunities there for us to think about choices that would be in line with our values to support small farmers, to support the environment, and also now we're learning to choose a climate-friendly diet. So clearly there are those things that we can do every single day. And I personally have always loved the way my mother has talked about those personal eating dietary choices, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but the way that you've described it as sort of making those daily choices, it's also like putting a string around your finger as a sort of reminder about the ways in which our lives are connected to lives that we may not even ever know about, to people we might not ever even meet. And how can we make those choices in ways that are respectful of people and the planet, right? So I certainly don't discount those choices. But I also feel like when we're talking about something on the scale of addressing a fundamentally broken system, the way in which our food system is fundamentally broken, I don't think that we should expect that we can simply change that by buying organic in season produce and not Pop-Tarts, right? It, just in the same way, I think we have a deepening public understanding of the need, for instance, to put major public investment in green energy, in transforming our energy sector. I think we've developed a little bit of that consciousness as a national community, a little bit. I think we're starting to get that around transportation, this need for public investment in transportation. You know, I don't think we would put the burden or the onus on the shoulders of an individual to go out and start excavating a subway tunnel, right? We expect there to be infrastructure development and investment. So similarly, I think we should be starting to have that conversation and really get it out there and speak up loudly for the need to have green food infrastructure and for the need for a radical investment and a radical redirection of how we grow food in this country that reflects these values of protecting the climate, protecting our health, and protecting also our rural economies.
And for that, we need democracy. What a concept, democracy. I think we're pretty close to the ultimate oxymoron in this country that I think of as privately held government, meaning that the very players that we're talking about here, the largest agribusiness corporations, have enormous sway that are diverting billions, literally billions every year, to support these industries that feed the junk food, that feed the ill health. By the way, it's estimated that soon obesity, food-related disease, will equal the burden of tobacco in our society in terms of other healthcare costs. So we need democracy, real democracy. What I like to think of is living democracy, if we're going to really turn toward the kind of public investment we're talking about. Imagine if we were using those billions to help small independent farmers move away from this extractive, destructive agriculture toward eco-agriculture, truly ecologically sound agriculture. And we can do that if, when, as we get money out of our political system and get our voices in. And so I'm one of my theme songs of my life right now is to remind us all that this is possible. There are now 3 states that have voluntary public financing for their state legislatures, and there's now a bill in Congress in both houses that called Fair Elections Now that would allow for a publicly financed election so that our right now there are now over 24 lobbyists for every person that you and I have elected to represent us in Washington. And under those conditions, exactly what Anna so beautifully laid out just then, you know, can't happen until, I mean, just take just one example here. I'm sure many of you saw this story about Monsanto a few weeks ago that pointed out to us the consequences of monopoly power. Monsanto, its germplasm that it owns patents on, is in 80 to 90 plus percent of key crops, key commodity crops of corn and soy. And guess what? The prices of these seeds have grown since 2001, 4 to over 6 times, depending on which seed you're talking about, over 6 times the consumer price index because of that degree of monopoly power. So how can we have a fair and open market under those circumstances? But it comes back to, in part, believing in democracy, that we can really get it back if we ever had it to the degree that we needed it, but certainly to move it forward to a democracy that is truly accountable to our common sense and our children's healthy bodies, you know. So that to me is, it may sound like a diversion from the topic about food, but to me it's right at the center.
Well, I mean, you've founded the Small Planet Institute as a way of bringing some of the visions of democracy outside the United States, to sort of infuse ideas about how social change might happen here. What in both your travels, particularly, I'm keen to bring this back to thinking about climate change. What have you seen that gives you hope? What is it that you think we could be learning from in other countries that could be happening here that can help remove some of the venom of money in our political system out of our democracy and actually give us something to start working with?
Which one of the many? do you want me to start? Yeah,
sure.
So when we wrote Hope's Edge together, it was my first book, and I think it was your 15th or 16th or something like that. we were really exploring the essentially the thesis that you put out in Diet for a Small Planet. This idea that hunger isn't caused by a scarcity of food; it's caused by a scarcity of democracy, and therefore, where are there people, communities, social movements around the world doing what you've just been describing, sort of bringing that democracy back to the food system. And so we traveled to India, Brazil, Poland, Kenya, France, Bangladesh, and Wisconsin, and here, the Bay Area.
Yeah, we started exactly 10 years ago.
And, what we saw was truly life-changing, I think, for both of us. And I'll just give you one really concrete example because it's just come up again really recently. And this is actually not, not a social movement, but what we can learn from government policy and shifting government policy. And that was what we saw happening in the fourth largest city in Brazil called Belo Horizonte. And so not a small town, you can imagine, fourth largest city in Brazil, quite a big city. And what we saw there and what we were drawn to there was the city government of this of Belo Horizonte had seen the very same levels of poverty and hunger that afflicted many cities around the world, many cities in Brazil. And instead of just throwing up their hands and saying, look, there's nothing we can do about it, let's just let the market work and believe in the magic of that free market, instead of just throwing up their hands, they said to themselves, wait a second. We have been elected by the citizens of this city, and we believe that basic access to good, healthy food should be a basic right of citizenship. And therefore, if any citizen in this city is not getting access to good, healthy food, then we, as a government of elected officials, have a responsibility to our citizens to help ensure that the market is working fairly and help ensure that people are getting access to good, healthy food. And by the time we were there, it was, 10 years after that? It was 7 years after this shift in consciousness among the city government happened. And out of that shift in consciousness, what had emerged were dozens and dozens of innovative projects to make the market work more fairly. It wasn't about spending more in government handouts and opening up 1,000 soup kitchens. It was about doing things like seeing where government money was being spent and using it more effectively. So looking at the school lunch program, for instance, and saying, wait a second, we are buying corporate processed food that has very little nutritional value with our government dollars, and our kids aren't getting the nutrition they need. Why don't we buy local organic produce that's healthier? We'll also be supporting our regional economy, and we'll be helping our kids' health right at the same time. So they transformed the school lunch program. They did things like they saw the influx of advertising from our fast food companies telling kids that they should be eating McDonald's and selling those Happy Meals. And they said, well, we as a government have a responsibility to educate our citizens about what's healthy food. And so they launched public education programs about healthy food and on and on and on and on. And what was so incredible to us was that they were already seeing within 7 years a dramatic improvement in basic childhood health indicators. They were seeing a dramatic improvement in the decrease in hunger in the city. And all of this was being done on, 1% of the city budget?
Yeah, I calculated it was 1 penny per resident per day. They reduced infant and child death by 60% in 10 years on one penny a day.
And what was so inspiring to us at the time, of course, was seeing this at work. And we came back to the U.S., and we've told the story many times. But what is particularly exciting about this moment in time, you asked sort of what are some of those things that have changed, is that so many of those insights and innovations that we saw in Belo Horizonte, we're starting to see in cities all across the country. So I currently live in New York City. We've just launched a really, really exciting Green Carts program where our Department of Public Health is sponsoring produce carts that are going out into low-income communities that currently have no access to fresh produce to sell fresh produce in those communities just like they do in Belo Horizonte. There's been now across the country a strong social movement emerging to transform school food like they have in Belo Horizonte. And I actually just heard from, I don't even know if I've told you this yet, but we just heard from colleagues who have, inspired by what they read in our book and inspired by the story of Belo Horizonte, are bringing a delegation of food activists and food policy people from the states to Brazil to learn lessons from what's happening now, not just in Belo, but across the country of Brazil.
And again, I mean, not to press a point, but the idea of, I mean, link that for me with climate change again, because, I mean, what one can see how, you know, a local government would feel compelled to address the needs of the hungry within its jurisdiction. But if, you know, if that food is produced by, you know, tons of industrial fertilizer, but that cost is borne elsewhere, then frankly, you know, what incentive is there for a local authority to give a damn?
Right. Well, there's a number of connections, and what we know now about the science of in this connection between food and climate is that in some ways, very complex, and there's still much to learn. On the other hand, there's some pretty basic principles that we know. First of all, we know that this reliance embedded into industrial agriculture, this reliance on synthetic fertilizer and on petroleum-based chemicals is fundamental to a huge part of why our food system has such a high climate cost. And so, therefore, turning to organic food systems, organic farming methods that don't rely on synthetic fertilizer but rely on natural sources for soil fertility, and that turn to natural practices for pest resistance and for weed control, that in that one shift towards sustainable systems, organic systems, that's a dramatic improvement for the climate. What we also know from research from places like the United Nations and the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania is that we also are able to tell, we're able to know now that those organic practices also, by their nature, help build healthy soil, and that healthy soil has a higher carbon content, that it can help store more carbon in our soils. And so folks like the Rodale Institute are arguing that if we were to convert all farms tomorrow to organic, which of course won't happen, but just speaking hypothetically to give you a sense of that, that we would be able to dramatically reduce our emissions in the atmosphere because we'd be able to sink so much of that carbon into the soils. So that's just one example of the way in which there's this food and climate connection, and therefore a direct way in which by supporting non-processed foods, local foods, organically grown foods are ways that local governments can really help reduce their overall carbon footprint.
Again, one of the criticisms of the organic food movement is that it's a middle class enterprise. That really, what's going on here is, you know, it's all well and good for people who can, you know, who can enjoy their tossed kale salad, but for people who are on low incomes, you know, worrying about climate change and food and organic is a distraction from the everyday necessity to be able to put food on the table. How does one respond to that? I mean, is there a way in which the strands of needing to address concerns of social justice and environmental justice can be brought together?
Mm-hmm. What I say, because we hear this all the time, this is the refrain. Talk about a compelling message to stop you in the tracks is to come back at you with the claim that you're being elitist or that you're actually potentially leading to greater hunger and greater starvation by your advocacy for sustainable food. I mean, talk about a way to say, oh, well, then I really shouldn't talk about this. Well, there's a couple things I would say. Number one, I would say that we can I think the strongest way to come back against that is to say, wait a second, let's ask ourselves, if you think it's elitist to be talking about organic food and organic farming and sustainable food, let's really talk about what's elitist. I think, personally, our current food system is elitist. It's elitist because right now, today, our current food system in this country shuts out almost 40 million people who are currently, today in the United States of America, food insecure, who don't have basic security about how they're going to feed their families. Talk about an elitist food system. Our current one is, by, I think, my definition of what would be elitist. So I think that that's one way to come back at that point. But I think, of course, we can also, I'm not going to deny, that in our current marketplace for food, a lot of times organic food can be more expensive. And I think that brings us back to my mother's mantra about democracy and this, and the need to, when we talk about food, to talk about beyond our own consumption choices and to talk about policy. Talk about what are the policies in place that have made it so that we can get that dollar burger at McDonald's, and it's not only can it be slightly more expensive to find organic, but actually, more to the point, it's hard to even find it. So I think that we need to remind ourselves that it's also the policies that are in place that are reinforcing the dynamics that make it hard for us to access this food, and when we do access it, hard to pay for it.
And I just wanted to add to that, that we often we have this image that somehow it's the, in the global north that this movement toward elitist organic is happening. Actually, some of the greatest leaders in this global movement are the poorest people. And I've just been taken with so moved by reading about women leaders in villages in Andhra Pradesh, India, Adrai, the Deccan Plateau in Andhra Pradesh, where villages now 2,000 have rejected the disaster that GM genetically modified seeds have brought them, and all the suicides from the crop failure, and are recreating the indigenous practices, the seed sharing, the diverse cropping, they're creating their own safety nets in their villages, and teaching one, and actually filming the evolution so that we can all see this. These are among the poorest people in the world, and they are in leadership in the organic revolution. And I could say the same thing about Africa, too. So we have to shift this idea that somehow this organic agriculture is in some northern thing.
And sorry, just to prepare the audience, we'll be going to questions in about 5 minutes. So if you have questions, now's the time to formulate them into sharp, pointed, well-honed, basic follow my example. Well-honed points and questions, and we'll be taking them in a moment. But I want to just then tie these two threads together. I mean, you're saying that genetically modified crops are a part of the problem. But you and I were at a seminar where Jeffrey Sachs was going to bat for Syngenta and for a range of life sciences companies, they call themselves, where they're offering that actually the one role for genetically modified crops, even if we discount all their failures in many other ways, possibly genetically modified crops can help fight climate change. What could possibly be wrong with that?
Right. Well, if any of you've heard the latest tagline from Monsanto or seen their latest ad campaign in the New Yorker or the New York Times, you know that what they're really coming out strong on this exact claim, and their latest tagline is how to squeeze water from every drop. And the claim is that these biotech crops are going to be the ones that enable us to create more drought-resistant crops. And I think, again, that's one of those compelling arguments, right? Who among us would want to say, no, let's not allow farmers to have access to this crop that's going to help them deal with drought? You know, we wouldn't want to deny farmers access if those crops were truly to exist, right? So I dug into the science behind these claims. I talked to people both from the industry side and also scientists who are very critical of biotech crops. And what I discovered is that, first of all, even insider industry folks themselves are saying that they're 10, maybe more years away from developing drought-resistant biotech crops. Even if they achieve that, it's not for right now here today. And what I heard from those that have been looking into these claims and the scientists who really understand genetic engineering and agricultural biotechnology, what they told me, what I heard again and again and again from all of these different people, is that drought resilience is a complex plant characteristic. And it is not something that you can simply engineer and drop one gene into a plant to achieve those qualities. It's highly, highly complex. And so everyone I talked to was saying, look, it would be a miracle if you could figure out how to do this, but certainly it's not going to happen anytime soon. And so then I found myself wanting to know, okay, so if we're not going to get that drought resistance and flood resilience from genetic engineering, then are we just really in trouble, or is there another path to achieve those qualities we know we'll need? And what I found was actually really encouraging. And what I found, again, very underreported in mainstream media, but what I found was that around the world, there's really amazing, compelling research of people who are working with small-scale farmers. There's this example that I found in Ethiopia that I write about extensively because it was so encouraging, of a research group in Ethiopia working with small-scale farmers in one of the most drought-prone regions of Ethiopia that have been working with farmers there to develop natural techniques, not relying on seeds from half a world away, not relying on chemicals that they need to buy, relying on natural techniques, organic practices, and that they found that turning back to the indigenous crops that were native to the region, turning back to these natural organic processes, what they're discovering is that they're actually able to grow crops and have high yields in those drought-stricken regions and faced with the drought that we know we are going to face all around the world. And what they were arguing to me is that, look, we're showing with these field studies that we have done, we're showing how to achieve this drought resilience right here, right now, today. Not in maybe 10 or 15 years. But not only, and I think this is especially key, they kept stressing to me, look, the other reason why this is so groundbreaking and so important is that what these small-scale farmers need are techniques that are also affordable. We're talking about farmers who have very, very little income. And the last thing they need is a technology that they're going to have to pay for, seeds that they're going to have to pay for, practices that are going to leave them in debt. And so there's stories like that coming out of Ethiopia, and we have examples of all around the world of sustainable practices that are actually achieving that drought resistance and achieving that plant resilience that we know we'll need.
And, of course, it's plant resilience, but also human resilience. And the beauty of this approach that Anna just described is that people are gaining confidence in themselves and realization that they can do this kind of experimentation. And that's the kind of realization that ultimately we're going to need, because climate change is going to have unknown variations on it. So
right.
It's that internal, that knowledge base and that self-confidence that is really the resilience.
Terrific. So can I just invite people to come up to the microphone if you have questions? I'm so glad so many people are coming. We can start with you if we're ready to roll. Yes.
My understanding is, I agree that, what we need to do is change the way, we have democracy in this country. But given our current situation of campaign finance, my understanding is that the president has disappointed a lot of food activists by his appointment to, head the Department of Agriculture. And the reason why, hamburger at McDonald's costs so much less than organic food is because of government policies. And I'm wondering, given the current realities, what can we do?
Great question.
That's a great question. And if I hadn't answered that question, then we would all, we could all, march out of here very, very happy. And I don't know if I necessarily have, the definitive answer, but I think just a couple of things I would say. First of all, you're absolutely right. This as we've talked about, this role of policy and the role of government subsidies, there's plays very much into the kind of food system we have. There's a great study out of Tufts University that actually pieced together all the subsidies that are currently given out to the factory-farmed meat industrial complex. And they estimate that between 1997 and 2003, we spent $35 billion effectively subsidizing the very kind of meat production that my mom talked about in Diet for a Small Planet, that I talk about, that is so destructive to communities, to climate, and so on. So clearly the status quo is creating this kind of food system that has all of these negative consequences. And I think that you're absolutely right that we are certainly challenged right now with our ability to really have our values heard on the national level. I think what we do, though, have an opportunity when the Farm Bill is up for a renegotiation in 2012 to continue what I think began during the last Farm Bill and even a few Farm Bills before, but really a broad-based social movement that I think helped many more Americans than ever before understand that the Farm Bill, A, exists, B, is worth a lot of, takes a lot of our tax dollars and puts it in a lot of places where we don't want it to go, and C, that we can have some influence over it. Now, I don't think that the Farm Bill is going to automatically flip on its head and all of a sudden, instead of a tiny percentage of our tax dollars going to organic, you know, 99% will, but I still think that there is value in fighting that fight. And we saw it during the last Farm Bill in terms of what we achieved, and I think certainly we know that if we don't fight that fight, that Farm Bill now, we know, not only will be food policy that will continue to incentivize food that's not good for us, we also know that that Farm Bill and that food policy will also be bad climate policy. So I think the more that we can awaken each other to get engaged around the Farm Bill and sort of leading up to the Farm Bill and realize that we might not see, it might not be exactly what we want, but we can still have influence, I think that is, I think, an important thing to focus on and talk about.
And another sort of entry point and leverage point is with institutional purchasing, that there's mm-hmm. been a very fast-growing movement that's so exciting called Real Food Challenge, which started by a group of young people who made the target of, I think, 100 campuses the first year that would go 20, that the demand for their campus to be in the next 10 years, 20% purchases for the food service would be local, organic, and fair. And instead of 100 or so, they're now close to 400 campuses that they've gotten administrations to sign on to this goal. So that shows you the kind of energy. And then in addition to that, of course, of the farm-to-school movement that's happening. But I would also say to the question that let's remember that democracy is a food issue. A food issue is democracy. So it's not an either-or, that we've got to keep our eyes on the prize of actually getting our voices being heard within every aspect of government. And this system of voluntary public financing, we know it works at the state level, and it now can work at the federal level.
So it sounds like there's an agreement that climate change disproportionately affects low-income communities, communities of color. But how do you translate the issue of climate change linked to food insecurity to these communities who might be hardest to reach with this message?
Good question. Well,
just food is great.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a really good question, and I think I feel like what we've certainly seen is that a lot of these communities that have been hardest hit by these issues are actually those who are kind of leading the way and are actually on the ground. Again, maybe we're not hearing about it in the mainstream media, but on the ground, really engaged with some of the most radical transformative change, and so. You know, I think we're seeing that here in this country and as well as around the world, that I think there's a myth out there and that the only way that people can have kind of an environment, sort of understand that big picture environmental issues, right, and understand something as in some ways abstract as climate change, is and the only way those people can then start acting on that is if people have to have their kind of basic needs met, have to have a roof over their head, have to have basic shelter, and then they can reach those kind of higher values. And we've heard this myth promulgated by even so-called environmentalists have sort of put this myth out there. And what I think we've seen with our own eyes is that actually some of the most radical environmental movements are emerging from some of the communities that have the least economic power. So we don't sort of have to first ensure that people are reach a certain economic wealth for people to get environmental issues, that actually we can learn a lot from movements like the landless workers movement that we met with in Brazil, movements like the farmers movement that Vandana Shiva is engaging with in India. So that's one thing I would say on that.
And in Niger, you know, in West Africa, where we think of the descending desert and the drought there as endemic, 12.5 million acres of land have been re-greened by poor village people in Niger in the last 20 years, planting trees and shrubs and reclaiming the land for food as well as the reforestation. 12.5 million acres. And, you know, we don't hear about it here, but these are the poorest, some of the poorest people on the planet.
Just a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum, and tonight we're hosting Anna LaPay and Francis Moore LaPay. My name is Raj Patel, and we have about 5 minutes left, so we can see if we can squeeze in the last two questions.
Hi. So you mentioned the need for green food infrastructure. I'm curious what that would look like, in your opinion, and how eating meat sustainably produced fits into that equation as well.
Uh-huh. Great. Yeah, so what would green food infrastructure look like? I mean, first of all, it would mean a radical shifting of where our dollars go, and especially determined by the Farm Bill, a radical shift of that away from subsidizing commodity crop, massive commodity crop production, like corn and soy, across most of this country, most of which is going to our feedlot meat. It would mean really investing in those organic farming practices. It would also mean, therefore, putting a lot of resources in training people in working on the land and being farmers. You often hear people say we've come to a place in this country where less than 2% of people are farmers, and that less than 2%, therefore, of people are bringing us our food. In fact, at that Jeffrey Sachs event that we went to together, he said that. He said, we're so efficient in this country, less than 2% of our population feeds us. What he misses when he uses that statistic is the USDA's own figures that tell us that actually over these years, as we've lost those farmers on the land, it's not that less people are bringing us our food. It's our food economy and food jobs have shifted to some of the most exploited and underpaid jobs in the country. They're meat packers. They're food processors. They're food distributors. They're working at places like Walmart. So actually, there's as many people bringing us our food. They're just not on the land doing it. So part of green infrastructure, although I guess, you know, people are infrastructure in some ways, it's not sort of bricks and mortar infrastructure, but part of it is also a reinvestment and a revaluing of farming. And then the third piece of it is also revaluing regional food systems. And so bringing back the infrastructure that we need to be able to say, for instance, in New York City, we have great New York State grown lettuce, but we have no processing plant and no distribution channels to bring that lettuce into Manhattan. And instead, we're shipping it from the Northwest where they have that infrastructure in place. So thinking about how communities can rebuild the regional infrastructure to create a more rational food system where we're not shipping things all across the country and back and forth, but we're actually supporting our local economies and putting that infrastructure in.
We've got time very quickly for the last question.
My question is also on the infrastructure, and I came to food security through Jane Jacobs' books, firmly believe that healthy relationship to food is a healthy community. And this infrastructure question comes up more and more because it's that final mile that seems to be missing from farmers to consumers. You talked about green carts, you talked about infrastructure, but there's also seems to be some zoning changes and some urban planning issues here around healthy food that are missing. And I was wondering if you've done any work in that and working with the mayor's office or in your communities or the authorities to create small food manufacturing zones and those types of things to actually bring a smaller, more artisanal scale to our food system.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the beginning, Raj, you were asking sort of what's changed. You know, we're beating our, you know, I feel like my mother's been saying many of these core messages for 40 years, and now I'm saying many of the same things. And what's changed question, and I think that question brings up to me some of the positives of the what's changed that you're starting to see in communities that before didn't necessarily bring the food lens in, bringing that food lens in. So in the planning communities and planning schools across the country, having that conversation about food is becoming more part of the curriculum or part of the conversation. In the public health community, you're seeing this conversation about food systems come in. And in nutrition schools, where before there was no conversation about the story behind the nutrient in that food, you're starting to see this conversation about food systems. So I think that is really encouraging. And in terms of what we're seeing around this zoning and around these planning issues, absolutely. I think across the country, in my own sort of almost anecdotal kind of visiting cities and talking to local leaders, seeing city governments really getting it that there needs to be this conversation about how we invest in that infrastructure. And there's opportunities now with the Obama administration's Healthy Food Financing Initiative. It's $400 million. It hopefully could be a lot more. But initiatives like that that are specifically about putting in that infrastructure, putting in those resources for healthy food, for local foods in communities that most need them.
Well, before we come to a close, there is a new tradition in 2010 that we're asking all speakers to do. I'm going to be asking you both, if you could, give us your 60-second idea to change the world. And I'm not sure who wants to dive in first. Frankie, Anna?
Well, while the clock is ticking on this one, I do have to say it's very exciting to be on stage with apparently the Messiah and my mother. I don't know if any of you heard that apparently Raj is the Messiah. Yes.
I was defrocked earlier on today.
Earlier on today.
The man
Breaking news.
Who thought
you heard it here first.
Okay, so that's doll. That bought us a few minutes
it
there.
Did,
okay, so our 60-second, it was the 60-second
yeah,
idea.
What is your 60-second idea to change the world? I believe it's not what would you do in 60 seconds to transform the world, but rather in 60 seconds, could you
if
distill
for us?
If you're not the Messiah. Well, I'll go first. Let's see. I mean, maybe this is just a complete cop-out, but I would appoint my mother president of the United States of America.
That is a cop-out. You still got 30 seconds left.
And then I would do
I'll give her my remaining
right,
seconds.
Right, we've got a minute and a half, Frankie. Off you go. Or should I say President Frankie?
President Frankie. Well, now that I'm a president, I guess the song of my life is to really believe that we can do this thing, democracy, that the new, if I could wave a wand, it would be to really have us all believe in the revolution and understanding human nature, how profoundly wired we are to be cooperative and to be co-problem solvers and co-creators in all these ways we're talking about tonight. So it would be, if I could change the world, that we all believe in a truly living democracy. Democracy is engaged practice and not something done to us or for us by moneyed interest, but really the good life. And to me, this kind of dialogue tonight is part of that sort of living democracy.
Thank you so much. You tolerated the cruel and unusual punishment that the Commonwealth Club has concocted for you with grace. Thank you very much indeed. Let's give a big hand to Anna and Francis Morlepay for their thoughts. And now this morning of InForum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.